Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Who was the last one?
Linda Sue.
It's Mimi, but I can't stay on the call. I just wanted to get the recording started.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm at a Shiva call. Okay?
Don't worry.
I got you
Thanks.
Started. All right.
Okay.
So,
thanks.
All right.
Thanks a lot. Okay. I'm going to begin now. I have some very interesting things that I would like to share with you that I think you'll find quite interesting also. All right. I'd like to, there's a little known halacha regarding tefillah and regarding prayer and learning, limud. First of all, I'd like to contrast. It's shown that it's taught that prayer and learning, of course, are both mandated. I think we're the only religion where learning is a commandment, but they're both quite different. If I were to ask you the difference, I mean, you might have different opinions and different definitions. They're both essential mitzvot. They're both two distinct entities and serve totally different functions. It's similar to people feel that they tie together tefillin and davening, which I pointed out are two distinct mitzvot, one really not having much to do with the other, except for the fact that since we don't wear tefillin all day anymore, so we put them on only in the morning for the shacharit service, and that really was for a convenience, but they are two separate mitzvot. But getting back to prayer and learning, the best definition I ever heard was that prayer is man talking to God, and learning is God talking to man. Does anybody want to comment on that? Did anybody ever hear that before? Prayer is man talking to God. Learning, when we learn Torah, that's God talking to man. So that's the first
sounds like something Heschel might have said.
Say it again, Neil.
That sounds like something Abraham Joshua Heschel might have said in one of his books.
Yeah, he very well may have. He very well may have, but it has been said by other people. Now, interestingly, I'm going to get into the very interesting concept of any mitzvah that we have, with maybe one exception, but any mitzvah that we have, we always have a blessing before. We have a blessing before and a blessing after, usually. We often think of just eating with blessings, but we have blessing before we study Torah. Every day we make the blessing before we study the Torah in the Shacharit service, and it's followed by the written law, the Mishnah, and then the Gemara. If you look, you'd see what I mean, but it's just a snippet of each to fulfill the mitzvah of learning Torah in the morning, and then throughout the day you don't have to make the bracha again, but Torah mandates making the blessing prior to learning Torah, and the Torah mandates making the blessing after eating, which is very, very interesting, because the question would be, before the question, that's the oraita, right from the Torah. We have to make a blessing before we learn Torah, but the blessing from the oraita, we make the blessing after eating. So what did the rabbis do from the Rabbanan? They said, not only, since the Torah says you make a blessing after you eat, you also make one before. The rabbis legislated to make it before, which is obviously the motzi, the tilat yadayim, the motzi, and then you eat, and then the Torah mandates doing the birkat after. Learning Torah is just the opposite. The oraita, you make the blessing prior to learning Torah. And the rabbis legislated making a blessing after. So hence, when someone gets an aliyah, they do the blessing first, Asher Bochar, the Torah is read, and then they do Asher Natan after. Now the question I'm going to ask you, I'd be interested to see, there is a definitive answer, by the way, which is a beautiful answer, but I would be interested to know if anybody has an idea as to why the Torah legislates first making the bracha after eating, but before learning Torah. Anybody have any ideas about that? And I can give you a source of each if you want, but that's up to you if you want the source. I'll give you the source. Of course, the source of the eating is easy. V'yachalta, v'savata, v'erachta. I mean, that's the source for the... the source for learning Torah is a little bit more complicated, and the Talmud in Brachot 21a explains where it comes from and how it's how we extrapolate that from the Torah. But does anybody have any ideas as to why the Torah would have you make a blessing prior to learning, but make the blessing after eating? And it's a very interesting concept. Anybody? Benny, are you there?
I'm here, yes. I don't know, I'm just listening.
Good.
Just come on.
This is,
oh,
this is
okay.
Naomi.
But you heard
this
the question.
Yes.
Naomi?
Benny answering? Yeah, I was going to venture a guess.
Okay, let me just make sure. Benny, did you hear the question?
Yeah. Why, yeah.
Okay. Okay, Naomi, what's your venture, your idea?
Totally a guess, but first of all, I'm going to guess that you can't really praise God for food if you're hungry. That it doesn't just say the achalta uverachta, it says the achalta v'savata uverachta. So there's something about being satisfied and then blessing and, you know, experiencing appreciation of God. And with Torah, you already know it's God-given. You already know that Torah was given to us and we were chosen to receive it, so that you could bless before.
Well, with the eating, you're on to something. But with the blessing, you're saying such and such, and that's why. But you really are not hitting the crux of it. But you're on the right track. Does anybody else have any ideas? You're very, very good. The answer, the definitive answer to that is, it's human nature that once you've eaten, you forget God. In other words, you ate, you're satisfied, you know, the typical Thanksgiving meal, you have a big turkey dinner and you go off to sleep. So the point that Torah brings out, and Naomi, you're on the right track, that after you... to say you do it after because of the verse, that's not the question. The question is, why is the verse doing it after? That's the question. Do you follow me?
But what I was pointing out is it doesn't just say ve'achalta uverachta, it says ve'achalta v'savata uverachta. That was the point that I was making.
Understand, but what would that have to do with doing it after? That's my point. I know we do it after. We know
that
and it says...
That a person who's not satiated, a person who hasn't eaten, isn't going to bless.
You got it backwards. You say
the real thing.
Isn't satiated, they're not going to bless. The point is that why... I see what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. But then the question is asked occasionally. You know, according to the pasuk, it says, and v'yachalta v'savata. So let me ask you, if you ate a meal and you weren't satisfied, so therefore are you not required to bless?
It's not that you're not required. It's that, it's certainly not required. It's just that you're more likely to do it with, spirituality and belief and faith because you've been satisfied than if you haven't. That's all.
I have a thought about this. I think that what Richie is pointing out is that the feeling of satiation when you eat and you are satisfied, your inclination is not to bless; it's to walk away. You're
exactly.
Drunk. And so
exactly.
We have to have a mitzvah, a commandment to do it. But in the case of studying Torah, You're constantly involved in the study of mitzvot and all that sort of thing. So you bless first.
And that, not only that, that's excellent. That's the point. And in the study, and to carry in the study of the Torah, it's like you can't wait to study because you realize how great it is. So, the opposite. Once you've studied the Torah, you realize how great it is. But the point is that you're legislated to make the bracha before, because it's sort of the opposite, that once you study the Torah, you're going to praise God. It's not like you're satiated and you go to sleep. So therefore, the Torah mandates, since the nature would be to the inclination to do the opposite, it mandates that you make the bracha before you study the Torah, and then the Rabbanan say after. Look, that can be argued, but that's the rationale. But exactly what you said, that it would be your inclination not to do it, and therefore that's why the Torah mandates doing it. But the other question is, it's a very interesting question, that what if you're not satisfied? What if you're not satiated? Actually, there's a halacha, believe it or not, that says if you're mentally distressed and distraught, you're not even supposed to daven. So there are times where, you know, there might be an issue. And on the other hand, when you have your meal, I mean, obviously, it's the whole thing is a holy. We take and we make the whole meal, elevate the whole idea of the meal, make the blessing before and after, and you wash your hands, and actually in religious circles you talk Torah even at the table. You talk Torah, and on Shabbos you have Zemirot and so on and so forth. Now, along these same lines, it's a very interesting halacha regarding Rosh Chodesh, regarding Alev Yavo on Rosh Chodesh. And the halacha is as follows. And I have to say, when I was studying this, I could not come up with the answer myself, and I was fascinated by the answer. The question is, according to halacha, if you're davening, you know, you're doing Shachas, Mincha, or Ma'ariv, you do the Amidah, and you forget. You forget Yalev Yavo. The halacha is you're supposed to go back and repeat the whole thing. If you forget it at the end, you repeat it, and that's it. On the other hand, Yalev Yavo is also included in the Birkat HaMazon, as you know. And the halacha is if you forget it during the Birkat, you don't repeat it. So the question is why. And when I was studying this and saw why, I would never come up with the, could never come up with the answer, but I did give it to somebody, one of the people in class. I don't think she's here today, and she researched it and so on, and she sent me back the answer, but it was not the definitive answer. Does anybody have any idea as to, does anyone want to venture a guess? Why is it on, when you do the Amidah, you have to do it, repeat it if you forget the Alev Yavo, but if you do the Birkat and forget it, you don't? Anybody? I didn't want to spook you by saying I couldn't figure out the answer. Somebody very well may figure out the answer. It's not that, I would say, abstruse, but anybody?
Richard, maybe
okay.
The Amidah is more mechuyav, more vechiv.
No, that would be a good answer, except that you're on the right track, except that, okay, actually you are on the right track. Okay, davening is mandatory. And what Benny's saying is that the Birkat is not, but the Birkat is chiyuv. The answer is that davening you have to do come hell or high water. That's a chiyuv, absolutely. Birkat is also a chiyuv, but with the proviso, if you eat. So you don't have to have bread, and you don't have to do the birkat if you don't have bread. So in essence, Benny, you're right. But since you don't have to do it, if you happen to have bread and you do the birkat and you forget it, so you forgot it. I mean, it's not the same. and that's really the answer. So with that said and done, you might ask the question, Myriv really isn't a chiyuv either, became so. But the answer is, if you forget it from Myriv, you also have to repeat it. And that's, yeah, someone?
I'm sorry, it's Marcia. I have a question. So if the understanding is that you did shacharit or you did mincha, and you forgot Yaleza Yavo, but you went back and you repeated it, then if you bench later in the day, haven't you already in some way or another fulfilled your obligation to say Ya'alev Yavo because you did it in the Tefillah?
No, not at all. It's a good try, but it's totally, totally different because again, as Benny said, the Birkat is not a chiyuv unless you eat. So, I mean, it's a different category. The question I thought you might ask, which would be more relevant, would be if, let's say, you forget the Alev Yavo and it's Shacharit or Mincha, and you have a Shliach Tzibur leading, so you could say when he leads it, he's going to do the Alev Yavo. So wouldn't you be Yotze for that? That would be more of the type of question that you would wonder. But the answer, but what you're saying, I mean, it's a good idea of the fact that you're saying it, but the beer cup. But again, what if you didn't eat and didn't say it? So you can't have like special rules saying, well, if you did the beer cup and Yalav Yavo and you forget it for the Amida, then you don't have to do it. But anybody who didn't, then they'd have to. It doesn't work that way. It has to be halacha, and that's what it is. You'll notice. In most congregations, I don't know if in yours, but when I grew up and wherever I was, someone, usually the gabbai or someone, right after, let's say, Goal Yisrael or whatever, for Shachris or whatever, they'd yell out, Yalav Yavo. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. So it would be unlikely that you'd forget it anyway. So that, but your question is a good question about, if it's included there, therefore. But the answer is no, it's separate. I mean, it wouldn't be the same. So any more comments?
Yeah. Just one more comment about what you just said about the gabbai yelling it out. Some shuls, especially shtiblach, have a, like in the churches, something in the front where they slip in a card that says Yalav Yavo on that occasion.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Like
thank you. That's an excellent point. In fact, and then they'll do the same Talamotar when it's December 4th, when you change the same bracha, you know what I'm saying? You know what I mean in the Amidah where you change on December 4th. Yeah. So they'll also insert that. But you're absolutely right. That's an excellent idea, too, that, to have that. Very good point. I just want to hit upon something, though this class is not on the weekly portion. I want to hit on something in Yisro, which is fascinating, and I've taught this before, and I've always found it fascinating. In chapter 20 of Yisro, and it says, I'll just give you the translation here, and all the people saw the voices. They saw the voices. And of course it goes on, and the sound of the shofar and the mountain and so on. Very interestingly, the question is asked, how can you see voices? You hear voices. It says they saw the voices.
Which pasuk is
that? I'm sorry?
Which pasuk is that?
15. You have your chumash there?
I do. 15 what?
Okay. Read it to us. I'm doing it. Chapter 20. It's in Yisro, obviously. Chapter 20, verse 15. Mm-hmm. And there's two. I have an answer which is rather interesting. It's a bit mystical. My answer is, it goes to show you how advanced the Torah was, because obviously people couldn't see voices in that time in the literal sense, We have technology today where you can see voices. I mean, you see people will talk, and then you see the way it is. And I have a better one that how about when you talk and it goes on the screen, the words are on the screen, so you could see the voices. So that's not so remote. It's another interpretation would be it's almost like if you see the light, I saw the light. It doesn't literally mean the light.
Well,
but you saw it. You understood it. Go ahead. Read what you have it there.
Yes, I do. The cholam roim et hakolot ve'et ha'lapidot, lapidim.
Torches. Yeah.
Right, but it's referring to the. If I'm not mistaken, it's referring to the thunder and lightning, and if I'm not, and if I were kind of reading this. It's not taking the kolot is meaning thunder in this case instead of voices, if I'm not mistaken. And I think the phrase et hakolot ve et halapidim is like it's a combination of some. It's thunder and lightning. It's thunder and lightning together.
Metaphor. It's a metaphor.
Sorry, well, I'm not sure if I look at it as a metaphor or whether I take it literally, but if I took it literally as witnessing the thunder and lightning, because if I'm not mistaken, they're at at Mount Sinai. Is that right?
Yeah, but the point is a metaphor means that the thunder and they're using different words, so that's a metaphor for thunder and lightning. Because if it was not a metaphor, it would say, and they saw the thunder and lightning.
It's interesting that Hertz.
Wait, I'm sorry, Richie. Can you just say what you said again? Because I'm not sure I understood what you said.
Okay, when I said it was a metaphor, you said you didn't agree that it was a metaphor.
Well,
I'm saying
a metaphor
means it's another a word for something else. If you're saying it meant thunder and lightning, they're using the word voices and torches. Obviously, voices is not thunder, torches is not lightning, but if that's what it means according to what you're saying, it's a metaphor.
I'm just reading the English of the JPS translation.
No, I understand, but I was saying it's a metaphor. Yeah, someone else has something there?
It's Keval here. Hertz.
Oh,
Hertz,
hey, how are you doing?
Hertz translates it as perceived.
Right, exactly. 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 But I'll tell you a bit. But Rashi, let me just say, go ahead, finish. I'm sorry, you want to say something?
Okay. This is Linda Sue again.
Linda, go ahead.
The JPS translation is witnessed rather than saw. And so witnessing is not just with your eyes, but kind of with more senses. And it just, if they're. One does not witness thunder without lightning because we know from science that the lightning actually comes first. And even though we say thunder and lightning, it really is lightning and thunder. But
Bobby Keval said was perceive is what it really means. Witness it doesn't mean witness. It means perceive.
No, he said that that's what Hertz translated it as. That's the
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, but that is more accurate. And if you look at a lot of it, Rashi has a very interesting comment, which Rashi says, and all the people saw, this teaches us that there was not that there was not one blind person among them. From where do we know that there was no mute person among them? The Torah states, and all the people replied. And all the people replied. That's in Shmot 9, chapter 19, verse 8. So from where do we know that there was no deaf person among them? The Torah says, Nasev Nishma, we will do. And that's from the filter. I mean, obviously, it's a nice warp, but that's what he says. And the voices, they saw what was audible, which is impossible to see elsewhere. This is from another culture. So not everybody agrees with the thunder and lightning. And because the voices, and the way I always learned it was, the voices emanated from the mouth of the Almighty. That's why when I gave the original thing, saw the voices, a lot of interpretations is it was the voice of God. Many voices coming from every direction and from heavens and from the earth. And then, see, it's followed, but the reason that makes a lot of sense is because the next verse says, they said to Moshe, you speak with us and we will hear, but let God not speak with us lest we die. And from that they infer that the very first two of the Aseret Dibrot, the very first two commandments, they actually heard the voice of God, whatever that means. But it was so overwhelming that they said, "We can't. It would be like looking in the sun. If you look in the sun, you're going to go blind." And the sun is only a creation of God. To hear the voice of God was so overwhelming, they said, "We can't take it anymore. If that continues, we're all going to die." So that's one of the traditional interpretations. Bobby, have you heard that before?
Yeah.
Richard?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, you debated for a long time. I wanted to get in the word, but you can't get in the word there. I have...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. You know, there's a lot of problem with the static on this line. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Ben.
Well, he doesn't speak English anyway, so.
I don't speak English anyway. The two books by Rav Benny Lau, who is the nephew of Rav Israel Lau, who's always interviewed
right.
on the Israeli television on a Friday morning, Sipur Mehaftarah. He writes as if it happens today. And about this whole question about the Kol Ha'am Roim Et HaKolot V'et HaLapidim, he
right.
quotes Yalkut Shimoni, and he says
right.
in very simple words, Yitro, whatever, Yalkut Shimoni, says that Bnei Yisrael came to Moshe and said, "We want to see in our own eyes, not Me'achorei HaPargod. They don't want to see, Be'amud Anan," but God said, "Well, Be'amud Anan," he says, "We don't want to see God through a Pargod. We want to see him." So God says, "Okay, ten Lahem, give to them." And then when Amud Anan came and says, no, we want to hear God. I can quote it. The book is in the other room. And then he said, "Well, okay, we want to hear God. If we cannot see him, right, then we can hear God." And then when God uttered the Aleph of Anochi, I understood that only not the first two Dibrot, but the first Dibra, according to whatever Midrash that I learned, is that when God intoned the Anochi, that's when the whole people of Israel, you know, died out. And they were revived again. But
right.
That's what he said, "V'chol ha'am ro'im et ha'kolot v'lapidim." So they saw it at the same time.
Yeah, in fact, the way I recall is that they died. You're absolutely right. They died, they were revived, and they died again the second one, and they were revived. Both times. But at that point, they realized that they probably wouldn't be revived if this kept happening. So they pleaded with Moshe to. But anyway, that's absolutely right what you're saying. As long as you mention the Aleph, I'll give you a little bit of interesting gematria on this. The Aleph is comprised of a Yud, a Vav, and a Yud. If you look at that's the way it's designed. The yod above, the vav in the middle, and the yod below. And what's the numerical value?
26.
That's the whole thing with the yod hey vav hey, the same thing. 26. It's very interesting if you look at it. The aleph, and there's so much with it with the aleph that's you can learn a whole lesson just on the Aleph alone. So with that said and done, I'm going to continue with a very interesting, obviously we have Shabbat every week, and there's some interesting halachas for Shabbat that I want to point out. There's a gezeiras called Shechikas Samamonim, and which is the Rabbanan, prohibiting taking medicine and performing medical treatments on Shabbos. Now, this is very interesting. Well, what does that mean? You're supposed to die? So Chazal feared that when a person is beset with a pain or illness, he might act irrationally, and the Mechalel Shabbos of the prohibition of Shechikas HaMamonim, which, what does that mean? It's the grinding medicinal herbs. Now if you recall, I mean, Bobby, you may remember, they would take medicines and they would actually, it's not compound, what's the word I'm
yes,
thinking
it
of?
Compounding. It's called
it compounding. Is compounding?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Okay, they would compound the different medicines
the way,
and so on.
A mortar and grind it with a pestle and then put it into
Exactly. So that was obviously prohibited. So now you'd say, and remember last week, I explained the concept of lo plug. Now, even today, when the use of, obviously they don't do too much grinding. It's not going to be, this gezeira still applies. And for instance, now I'll give you an example. I recall in my yeshiva days, if somebody had a headache, you weren't quick to take an aspirin or whatever. They didn't have Motrin in those days. But so what did the Rebbe would say to you? Don't worry, Shabbos will definitely cure the headache. And if you waited long enough, it went away. So that was one thing. You're really not supposed to take medication because Shabbos is going to cure the headache. But now I'll get a little bit more. Which to us would almost seem ridiculous. But for instance, you're not allowed to drive on. Let me get back to it. Anything pikuach nefesh, anything that pertains to your serious endangerment. Obviously, you're not. It's not only you're allowed to. You must violate Shabbos. So I'm going to give you a story. This is a person I know, and I know what happened. And he's an Orthodox rabbi. His wife went into labor on Shabbos, and he's very right-wing Orthodox. He didn't think a second, took his wife, went in the car, drove to the hospital, got to the emergency room, got out of the car. Now, here comes the rub. He wouldn't dare turn off the ignition key. Why? And I talked to him about it. He said he had to turn it on and start the car and go to the hospital. But once he was there, he's not going to turn it off. That's Mechal El Shabbos. So he left the car there running with the key on. So that actually would be, that's how strict some of them are. And to get even more ridiculous, and this is hard to believe, and it took me a long time to even know that people actually would do this. According to halacha, if your house started to burn down, as long as nobody is hurt, you exit the house, you're not allowed to put the fire out. And I know personally of a family in Boston area, this happened to their house burned to the ground, they watched it burning with Shabbos. They wouldn't dare. So you'd say, why didn't they call the fire department? Because it wasn't pikuach nefesh. So that's how ridiculous, to us anyway, that's how ridiculous some of these things, could get. On the other hand, if you have a cholesh yesh b'sakana, if you have a life-threatening illness, in the case of life-threatening disease, then of course you violate any isurei deraisa. I mean, any of the laws of the from Torah and of kal v'chomer from the rabbanan when necessary to bring the life-threatening condition under control. Now I'll give you an example. This is a very interesting example. There's three exceptions to that. You're not allowed. If somebody came to you, pointed a gun at you, said, you kill this other person or I'll kill you, you have to allow yourself to be killed. Actually, you try like hell to kill the person that's holding the gun. That's perfectly acceptable. You're allowed to defend yourself. But that's one thing. The second is idolatry. Somebody tells you to you have to become another religion and idolatry, you're allowed to have yourself be killed for it. But even there, there was some leniency. That's where you got Muranos and that's where you got all of that, you'd make believe. And the third is the one that many today in this society is not even comprehensible, which is adultery. It's actually idolatry, adultery, and murder. And it's like if someone had a gun to your head and said you have to commit adultery, you're allowed supposed to have yourself killed for it. Now, to the modern mind, that sounds almost ludicrous, but that's definitely one of the three that you're not allowed to. In the Talmud, there's actually a situation it's fascinating. I can't tell you where of now, but I learned it a while back, where there was a Jew that had, he went to the Rav and so on. He had such a pathological drive, you might call it today a sex addict. He had such a pathological drive to commit adultery. And his doctor even said that if he didn't follow through with it, he was going to die. The rabbi said then he'd have to die. So it's an interesting Talmudic story. With that, to give a little bit of levity, and I'm sure some of you have heard this story. I'm sure Bobby Kivo heard this. The woman took her husband to the doctor. He was having all kinds of troubles. And the doctor examined him, and then he called in the wife, and the wife said, what should I do? And the doctor said, look, you're going to have to give him a daily bath. You're going to have to massage him. You're going to have to prepare the finest foods for him. And he went on and on, and she said, well, thank you. He went out. She went out. They're in the car. The husband said, well, honey, what did the doctor say? She said, he said you're going to die. So, thank you. I'm glad somebody, but that's the point. The point is that when it came to halacha, you're actually, in those cases, supposed to allow yourself to die. However, again, you have to use common sense. There's a concept called no-fail
l'mishkav. Obviously, some of our colleagues don't know that halacha.
Many people don't. And being the chairman of the ethics committee, I see it firsthand. No fail l'mishkav. What is that? One who is bedridden due to his illness. Now, it's very interesting because I was able to identify with this so well. I've had times where I've been so ill that I couldn't, if it was Yom Kippur, I wouldn't be able to go, I would not be able to go. Not even a matter of vocal, it was a matter I was just so sick that I couldn't even get out of bed. So the poskim define nofel l'mishkav as anyone who feels so sick that one would normally stay in bed, even if he pushes himself to go about his usual activities. So I identified with that because there were times that I was felt very ill. And by the way, when I tell you I was like that, I'm sure there's not one person in the group today that hasn't had the same thing. But there were times where I was quite ill, but pushed myself to go about the activities, and it was very uncomfortable. So it's basically saying that would still be considered nofel l'mishkav. You might say, well, I really can go and do it. I mean, I'm going to suffer. But again, it's common sense. So if one is suffering a severe localized pain to the extent that he feels weak all over, or to the extent that he must exert great effort to stay on his or her feet or to function normally, this would be considered nofel l'mishkav. So the Torah, in this case, the Torah doesn't exempt a sick person from the Isurei Shabbos unless his life is at risk. However, in this case, you would say your life isn't at risk, but Chazal permitted leniencies, three significant leniencies, in order to provide treatment and care for a person who is in that category of nofel l'mishkav. And the leniencies are, basically, one is permitted to ask a non-Jew to perform even Torah prohibitions when necessary to obtain a refuah for a nofel l'mishkav. Because ordinarily you can't ask a non-Jew to turn a light on Shabbos. Tell him beforehand. But if you have nofel l'mishkav, you can do that. The second one is the Rabbanan Isur of Shechikas Samamonim, the medication does not apply to nofel l'mishkav. So one may, therefore, take medication and perform other medical procedures to cure or relieve the pain of a nofel l'mishkav. So that, in that case, I'm sure one of you were thinking, or more was thinking, if you had a terrible headache, it seems almost barbaric to say you can't take medication. But again, we're not talking about a migraine that is so paralyzing that you can't do anything. We're talking about a little headache. You have a headache, so that's the difference. And the third one is, it's a very peculiar one, and I've always found it, I understand it, but I find it, is you're permitted to transgress almost any Isser de Rabbanan, provided that you do it with a shinui. Okay, that means in an abnormal or unusual fashion, a shinui. You know, I've seen that. It's as I say, it's a little silly. It's almost like saying if let's say you have to do something up something. Yeah, somebody has a comment. Okay,
no,
I'm hearing a noise, and then I don't know if somebody. Benny, did you want to say something?
No. I'm listening.
Okay, so let's say, for instance, somebody has to do something that you ordinarily is let's say picking up muksa for something. I don't know, picking up muksa. So the shinui would be, instead of picking it up with your right hand, you pick it up with your left hand. That's the shinui. That's the difference. So that's what that means. But that only applies to an ofel mishkaf. And then it goes on to talk about illnesses or pains that are not serious enough to cause one to stay in bed. They're categorized in, it's called mechush be'alma, minor ailments. So one suffering from such ailments is not given the leniencies of an ofel mishkav, and that person is not allowed to. That would be like having a headache, you know, an uncomfortable headache. So that would be that. Now the next thing is very, very interesting, and almost defies logic. And I'll see if any of you agree in what I mean by defying logic. We're talking about food and vitamins. Okay, so the question is, can you take vitamins? Can you take vitamins on Shabbos? Well, let me start by saying, a sick person may eat ordinary foods in a normal manner, even if they have curative qualities, and his intention is solely to cure his ailments. What does that mean? You know, oranges are supposed to be the good for colds. It's vitamin C. Okay. So what it's saying is, if you're sick, you still can eat an orange, even though it may have a secondary effect of helping the cold. You still, because that's an ordinary food, normally you can eat that. The topic of taking vitamins and supplements on Shabbos is complex, and there are many different opinions amongst the Gedolei HaPoskim. I'm gonna go into I find it just interesting, but I want to see if any of you see what I mean by defying logic. Now, for the sake of brevity, I'm going to only present the approach of Moshe Feinstein. He says, okay, vitamins. Obviously, vitamins do not have the status of food. Therefore, according to him, they may not be taken to cure an illness. What Moshe Feinstein is saying is, if you have a cold, you can't take vitamin C. Okay. What I'm saying is that, to me, defies logic. Does anybody disagree or agree? It would seem to me, if you have a cold, you'd want to take it. But the logic of that ruling is that Shabbos is supposed to, you know, cure these minor ailments. But that's number one.
I think that's going against what we know about Feinstein, because he was Mikael most of the time, Lekula.
I know that. You would think so. But I'm quoting. I mean, that defies logic, too. You're absolutely right. I mean,
I don't know if it's of Feinstein Psak, that in places that there was no Chalav Yisrael, because everybody else is, he made a heter to drink regular Chalav. I was under the impression that he's always Mekel.
I know he was. He was very Mekel, always. I mean, most of the time. But for some reason, he would say, you know, for the vitamins, they can't be taken to cure an illness per se. But however, here's the rub. He says a healthy person may take a supplement intended to prevent the onset of a cold. Do you get the difference? In other words, like what do they call it? Airborne? They have this airborne. In fact, I got some samples. I didn't even ask for them. I got samples. Airborne is supposed to help help your immune system and so on. He's saying if you're not sick, if you don't have a cold, you can take a sub. That would be a cooler too. I mean, you could take a supplement intended to prevent the onset of a cold. But it would seem to me that the opposite should be. You see, Benny, what bothers me about that is it's almost like saying if you're sick, you deserved it, and therefore let Shabbos take care of it. But if you're not sick, you can take a supplement. It just doesn't make sense to me. Now, the Magen Avraham, that was Rabbi Avraham Gambiner, the 17th century. He states that even a healthy person may not engage in acts of refuah, which is a bit of a paradox. If he's healthy, then why would he be engaging in acts of refuah? Probably he meant refuah in terms of preventing illness. I don't know. But anyway, according to Reb Moshe, this means that even a healthy individual may not take a supplement to improve his health. That's how he rules, Benny. Again, it seems more of a machmir type of ruling. So, in other words, he's saying to increase one's energy level or strength, you can't do that. Now, supplements intended to improve one's health are only considered refuah if one anticipates a significant and noticeable effect similar to the effects of medicine on a sick person. So it really has to do with your intention. So, I mean, according to him, a subtle improvement in one's health similar to the effect of an improved diet is not classified as a refuah. So, for instance, one who is on a reduced-calorie diet may take a multivitamin, multimineral to supplement the elements deficient in his diet, provided that his intention is only to replace elements missing from his diet and not to improve his health. So, it sounds a bit of a paradox, a contradiction. But anyway, enough of that. Anybody have any comments on that? Okay.
One word. Pill pool.
But that's good. I mean, that's all right. Now I'm going to go into the difference between we had started this, and then I was in the middle of the difference between Dioraita and Derabbanan. Before I do that, I had explained to you the concept of the way the Talmud explains Maris Ayin and Dan Lachav Schut. Bobby, you weren't here for that. You'll find this interesting. The Maris Ayin, obviously, is appearance, the way perception and so on. We have in our faith, we have to be very conscious of perception. So you'll note
well.
That. Yeah, right. Oh, Maris was a good friend. If you go into, let's say you saw a chassid with a beard and payas, and you see him going to McDonald's, I mean, he probably wouldn't go in because he's afraid people would think he's, although I've seen them going to go to use the lavatory. But what it says is, and I love the analogy, it says, Dan Lachav Schut, you have to judge all people with, fairly, with good, give them the benefit of the doubt. So, for instance, the example it gives, and I've given this example before, but it bears repetition. If you see somebody eating a meat meal and they're drinking milk, you have to assume it's coconut milk. So, therefore, you're not going to judge them harshly. They're drinking coconut milk. On the other hand, Maris Ayin, it tells you if you're eating a meat meal and you're drinking coconut milk, make sure you have the shells, the coconut shells, on the table. So that's the difference it gives. Now, as we have seen,
the hashgachas in around this neighborhood here. That they will not put a pitcher of non-dairy milk on the table at a chasana or something, but they only put the container on so that you should see that it's parva.
Excellent. That's exactly. That's exactly this. In fact, it's funny you say that, Bob, because I remember. Now this has to go back when parv butter came out. Well, they didn't call it butter. I think margarine was parv. Well, there is parv margarine. When that first came out, I recall my Orthodox rabbi, where I grew up, said that his family, his mother and father, could never, never have a meal, even though the 100% it was parv. They couldn't bring themselves to putting margarine on bread because of their background. It's the same thing with when the imitation bacon came out. I mean, it's kosher and it's parv, but a lot of people wouldn't have it because of the association. On the other hand, which is go ahead.
Neighborhood. I live in a Haredi neighborhood, and
they
all eat that fake crab meat stuff around here.
And do they really?
Yes, they do. And you would think that would be not
same thing.
Certainly, Morris Ion.
When
you go
but
into
today,
a
I mean, I'm sorry.
If you go into a Satmar place and they're serving it, you assume that it's under strict hashgacha.
Absolutely. I mean, but that's exactly the point, and that's very, very interesting. When you said it, it made me think of something, and I lost it. There was something I was going to say that the same when you said. And they have it at these affairs, and they have all of that, and so on and so forth. That's exactly the same type of thing. Now, as we have seen, Jewish law includes the Araita and the Rabbanan from the Torah, but a lot of the so-called halachas from the Torah, they may be implied, deduced, and so on. And then you have the actual laws that were enacted by the rabbis. Now, in a sense, however, even laws enacted by the rabbis can be considered derived from the Torah. That's where it's a fine line, because the Torah gives certain people the authority to teach and to make judgments about the law, which is right in Devarim chapter 17, verse 11. So these so-called rabbinical laws should not be casually dismissed as merely the laws of man, as opposed to the laws of God. And as we're taught, rabbinical laws are considered to be as binding as Torah laws, but there are differences in the way we apply laws that are d'oraita and laws that are d'rabbanan. And actually, in the Talmud, it is written that violating a rabbinical law incurs two averas, one for the actual violation, and two, the Torah says we are to listen to the sages, and we went through all of this, and therefore we've violated that additional command. But the first important difference is the matter of precedence. The Araita takes precedence really over the Rabbanan. I'll give you an analogy. It's hard for me to avoid because I'm involved so much with it. As a chaplain of the police department, and I'm with them four or five nights a week, and I go out on calls and so on. They have what's a high priority calls. Somebody would call, let's say, and say they had their television stolen, and we have to go, take the information. And then we get there, and they say, I called 4 hours ago. What took you so long? Well, we had a murder. We had a robbery. We had this. Everything is priority. The Araita is top priority. Now, if two Araita rules come into conflict in a particular situation, rules of precedence are applied to determine which rule is followed. However, if a Deraita rule comes into conflict with a Derabbanan rule, then what would take precedence?
Deraita.
Of course, obviously. Okay. Now the question comes. This is very interesting. Do we fast on Yom Kippur when it falls on Shabbat? These are both Deraita. They're both the Araita. I'm sorry?
Yom Kippur never falls on Shabbat.
Oh,
wait.
Yom Kippur Shabbat, Shabbat.
No, it never falls on Friday or Sunday.
It's going to happen this week.
Maybe where you live, but here it does.
It falls on Friday and Sunday. So the answer is yes, on Shabbat.
That's all right. I wish it didn't, but it does. Anyway, so these are both diraita. So rules of precedence must apply. Specific rules take precedence over general rules. So what's the specific rule of Yom Kippur? Fasting takes precedence over the general rule of Shabbat joy. And yes, we fast on Yom Kippur on Shabbat. However, the other fasts
occur on Shabbat.
There's one other, Bobby, which will shock you. Absolutely shock you. It shocked me, and that was one of the things I put in there. And when I tell you, I'll tell you in a minute. But the other fasts, the ones on the calendar that fall on Shabbat, are moved to another day. Now here's the exception. If you have, and it's right in the Shulchan Aruch, it's right in the Gemara. If you have a bad dream, a bad cholam, even if you have it Friday night, you have to fast the rest of Shabbat. So that's the only time. It's a very peculiar thing. And then what it says is, this is what makes it even more interesting.
Never heard of that.
I know, it's not common. You'll look it up, you'll find. And then if that happens and you fast on Shabbat, then you have to take another day and fast because you fasted on Shabbat. It's like a double whammy.
Yeah,
now the second important difference is the strictness of observance. Okay. If there is a suffix, a doubt, in a matter that is diraita, according to halacha, we become achmer, we take the strict position regarding the rule. We're talking if there's a suffix. If there is a suffix in a matter that is derabbanan, we are more, we're makel on that. Regarding the rule, so in Hebrew, this rule is stated safek deraita lechuma, safek derabanan lekula. Okay, now this is easier to understand with an example. I always like to give an example. Suppose you are reading the morning papers, and you can't remember whether you read the Baruch Hu and Shema. For some reason, you don't know. You're in doubt. There's a suffix whether you did the Baruch Hu and the Shema. And by the way, this may seem foolish to you, but as you get older, it's not so foolish because sometimes you forget. So the recitation of the Shema in the morning is a mitzvah d'oraita. So you must be machmir. And if you're not sure whether you did the Shema or not, you go back and you recite the Shema. Okay. The recitation of the Baruch Hu, on the other hand, is a mitzvah d'rabbanan. So you could be makel on this. You don't have to go back and recite if you're not sure. And if you are certain that you did not recite either of them, if you're not sure, then you go back and recite both. But the question you might ask is, how would you be doing the Baruch Hu by yourself anyway? So anybody have an answer to that? It would be if you were in a minyan and they did the Baruch Hu and you didn't know whether you answered, and then there was a second minyan. But actually, that halacha didn't make that much sense to me because of the Baruch Hu, so I'm not quite sure. I can't give you an answer on that. But I'll give you two examples of an extrapolation technique and a law derived.
They say the Baruch Hu again at the end of the davening for those people who came in late.
Absolutely, very good. And Bobby, do you recall if you would be in a yeshiva or a shtibel or something, somebody would come in and let's say after, and they'd want a minyan and they want to do the Baruch Hu for themselves.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? They came in, they were late, and then they got a minyan they got 10 people just to do the Baruch Hu. But what you're saying is that I've seen that too at the end, exactly, in case you missed it.
In all of the Nusach Sidurim, you will see that at the end of Myrav, the end of Shacharis, they say Baruch Hu.
Right, right. Were you brought up with Nusach Sfard?
No.
Oh, I was. And I remember the Keser, Yidin Lecha, the Kedusha, and so on. It was very interesting. Okay. The Bavli Gemara, the Babylonian Talmud in Megillah. This is very interesting. And there's a lot of different people have their own ideas. In Megillah 23b, Kaf Gimel B, base, it derives a requirement of a minyan of 10 for Kiddush Hashem and Devarim Shebikdusha, which are matters of sanctity. And this is how they do it. By combining three pesukim using the rule of Gezera Shava. So what do I mean? There's a word, besoch, and the word mitzvah in the verse. So it says, in Vayikra, chapter 20, because someone has a chumash there, you can, if you want, chapter 22, verse 32, chapter 22, verse 32, correct. And I shall be sanctified in the midst of the children of Israel. And then in Bamidbar, chapter 16, verse 21, the word betoch also appears in the verse. Separate yourselves from betoch from the midst of the congregation. Actually, you use the word mitoch ha'eda. That's the key, eda. Now, the term Eda is also used in another verse that describes what? Does anybody know? The Meraglim, the 10 spies. There were actually the 10 spies who brought back a negative report of Eretz Yisrael. And I'll get into something that is very, very interesting. So because they use that term Eda, you see, and then one more time, it says, how long shall I, and this is also in Bamidbar, chapter 14, verse 27, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation which murmurs against me? Again, so from this combination, the Talmud concludes that sanctification, Kedusha, should occur in Betoch, in the midst of a congregation of ten. Now, what's very fascinating about it is that in all of the cases, it's dealing with, it's a 10 evil people, the 10 spies, and so on and so forth, which from that we learn that you can have 9 Moshe Feinsteins and you don't have a minion, but you can have 10 Amei Haaretz, you can have 10 ignoramuses, you can have 10 even evil Jews, that will be the minion. So that's a very interesting extrapolation from that. Any comments on that?
No, but I want to tell you
about now. Yeah, go ahead, Benny.
Midoraita is Zachoret Yom HaShabbat, Zachoret Asher Asher Lecha Amalek. Shabbat Zachoret is Midoraita. Megillah is from the Rabbanon. So if you have a choice, either to go to a village next by to hear Shabbat Zachoret, or Megillah, what will you choose? Or what is more important?
Zachor.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. 100%. Very good point, Benny.
Yeah.
Very good point.
Doesn't make sense. Hopefully
you'll be able to do both. Yeah. Go ahead, Bobby. Someone?
No, I have nothing to say.
I thought someone started to say something. I wish the reception was better in this. All right. Now, we go to the Yerushalmi Talmud, which, okay, again, Megillah 4, chapter 4, verse 4. It offers two sources for the requirement, also using a Gezerah Shavah. The word congregation in the verse, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, is also used in the other verses, how shall I bear with this evil congregation, and so on. So since, again, the term congregation in the later verse refers to the 10 spies, so too in the form of you shall be holy refers to a congregation of 10. And the second source is based on the term B'nai Yisrael, which appears in the two following verses, and I shall be sanctified in the midst of the Bnei Yisrael, and that's in Vayikra chapter 22, verse 32. And then in Bereshis in chapter 42, verse 5, it says, and the children of Israel, again, Bnei Yisrael, came to buy provisions among the arrivals, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. So just as Bnei Yisrael in the later verse refers to the 10 sons of Jacob, again, that's the 10 sons of Jacob who descended to Mitzrayim to obtain food during the famine. So, too, the former verse refers to sanctification. That's pilpul. But now, I'm going to go to a different, you know, I haven't even looked at the time. Oh, my goodness. It's already time. Time went by pretty quickly. Fourth of the five that we're having, I'm going to start with, it was taught in the Baraisa, Reb Meir used to say that a person is obligated to recite 100 blessings every day. I'm going to get into that, and it's very fascinating. There's some very fascinating facts about that and so on. And I'll start that next week. And anybody have any parting words or any comments or suggestions? And Neil, are you still there?
Yeah, just want to apologize for being distracted and giving the wrong answer.
You didn't give a wrong answer for what?
Oh, about the Yom Kippur thing. I was distracted for a moment.
Oh, don't be. Yeah, you know something? If you didn't say it, everyone forgot it. Believe me. That's it's interesting, Deborah, what you're doing, because we all tend to do that. Sometimes we're our own worst enemy. Everyone makes all kinds of mistakes, and sometimes you make, you know, mistakes that you can't even believe you made, and if you make it, within a very short time, people forget about it. So there's no need to, you know, there are things, I mean, obviously Tisha B'Av can't be on Shabbos. The interesting thing about that is that's not an exactly accurate statement, because Tisha B'Av is the ninth of Av. So the ninth of Av can be on Shabbos. So when someone says Tisha B'Av can't be on Shabbos, they're wrong. What they're saying is Tisha B'Av cannot be observed on Shabbos. So what do? We go to
Nidche.
Sunday.
Nidche.
I'm Nidche. Sorry?
Nidche.
Yeah, right. Nidche. Right. That's right, too. Right. Explain that to him.
Means it's postponed.
Yeah,
right. We postpone, and there are certain things we postpone. I mean, but on the other hand, I'm just trying to think. I recall, believe it or not, I don't know if any of you ever heard this. I recall, in my yeshiva days, that there were certain gedolim, there were certain real frum people that would fast ninth and 10th, they'd fast for 48 hours because the burning continued on the 10th. Mm-hmm. And they would actually fast for the 2 days.
Why you're not allowed to eat meat the day after Tisha B'Av.
That's right. That's right. It's almost like, that's right. And in fact, you're not allowed to eat meat for the first 9 days, but also the day after. And that's a good point, Robbie. That's exactly the reason why. It's almost like Yisru Chag, except it's not Yisru Chag. But that's a very good point. Is anybody aware of, there is actually a situation that a bris would take place later than the eighth day. Does anybody know why? I'm not talking about illness or something. I'm talking about if a baby is born, Bein Hashmashos. Do you know, Bob, are you aware of what happens then?
Yes, I've heard of that.
It's funny because Richie Nadel told me that he said they did that for the convenience of the moil, which that's, to me, that's a cynical reason. But
well,
here's what happened.
There is a question.
I'm sorry?
There is a question as to when when exactly the time is, when it's the first day or the second day, because there's a nebulous little period in between.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And therefore, here's what they say. You listen to the reasoning. It's almost circuitous. Not circuitous. There's another word I'm thinking, but it means the reasoning is. We don't know. We're not sure, like you're saying, if he was really born on Friday or if he was born on Shabbos. Now, therefore, it's saying if he was born on Friday, then, of course, the bris would be the following Friday. But since we don't know, now we go to if he was born on Shabbos, the bris would be on Shabbos. But since we don't know, do you know when the bris is? The following Sunday.
Sunday, yeah.
So, I mean, Richie Nadel's reasoning does have some bit of logic to it, but be that as it may, that's the answer for that. And anyway, any more questions or anything? We will continue next. Mirz Hashem, Beli Neder. Next Sunday, 4 p.m., and I look forward to I'm very glad. I appreciate your attention and everything, and I hope nobody fell asleep. That's all.
No, I'm still awake. I'm going to Florida, so if I can get you from there, I'll get you from there.
I hope so, Benny. And you can send some warm weather this way, although the weather has been crazy, absolutely erratic and crazy.
Yep.
Cold spells, warm spells, you know.
Benny, don't hang up. I want to talk to you.
Yeah, Benny. Anyway, Benny, don't hang up. Bobby wants to talk to you.
Oh, is this Bob Kival?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll
see you all. Take care. Take care. Thanks for coming in.
Okay.
Bye. Bye.
Benny.
Hi. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you. Baruch Hashem.
Okay.
I'm doing a lecture on Wednesday for the student body on Yisroel Alter.
No.
Because. No. They sing so much music of his, and I don't think anybody there has ever heard him sing. So I took those.
That is my cry, because, first of all, you don't have. Do you have the CDs?
Yes, yeah, I have them. You sent them to me. So I took a couple of cuts off the CDs, and I made another CD. Gaina said she wanted to cry. So.
I have a lecture.
I took about 12 numbers.
I did many times in Jerusalem or in Tel Aviv at the Naftali School, and I'm doing it, and I did it at HSC, Israel Alter's contribution to the cantorate in the 20th century, where I dissected. I have a whole CD, which I made from different phrases, from the German mm-hmm. stuff, from the Chazone stuff, from the, you know, oratorio stuff, because the kids don't understand how to sing him unless they hear his voice.
Oh, I would like to hear that. Send me a copy of that.
Well, not the lecture itself. I will make. I'll make a copy of the. I'll make a copy of the snippets that I put.
Right.
And I'll send it to you. But the lecture is a script that I read.
All right. So then, send me a copy of that too.
But
I'd like to read it.
You know, with Hebrew and English, it's like footnotes. It's not really a full. A full language. I'll see what I can. Well, if I have it on an email,
I'm copying for them that the time that Akiva spoke and you introduced him and talked
about
your childhood. And
so let me just now. I will go and I will try to get the lecture itself, and I'll send it to you. I mean, there's a lot of personal thing there. You know, my own encounter with him.
Well, I'm going to tell him about my encounters with him when I told him I didn't like eating the fish because it had bones in it.
But you know something, Bob? Yossi Molovani heard that last CD, and he says, you know, Benny, it's not it's the Lose. It's not, you know, there are a lot of, like, he really didn't sing it like an opera singer.
No,
I mean, the Schumann
no.
and Schubert, all this stuff on the
and
top.
And you know,
very,
you know what
heavy.
I took, what I'm playing for them, the O Paradiso. It was the
yes.
best one of all of them.
Yes, 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 yes. Anyway, I'll see if I can find my lecture and I'll send it to you. It's unedited. It's not edited, and of course my English,
okay.
you know. But I will.
Well, we know you don't
CD,
speak
but
English.
I don't think you'll get it right away.
Mm-hmm. All right.
The CD which I put different. I'll pull it out. I'll try to make a copy of it tomorrow, and I'll try to send it to you. If you get it
okay.
before Wednesday, fine. But I don't think you'll get there by mail.
All right. So what?
But we you should have it for the future. But I'll send you the lecture itself.
Well, what you could do is you could put it on the computer and send it to me as an MP3.
No, but it's a long thing. I can't send it. I can't send a whole CD.
All right.
I wouldn't know how to do it.
So you'll send
unless
it.
Unless I'll ask them more in the office. How do I do it?
Mm-hmm.
I'll
okay.
see tomorrow if I can do it.
Whatever.
Yeah. Everything okay? Gena, the kids?
Yeah, the little one's got to go in for some surgery. He needs his tonsils out and his adenoids and his ears need, you know, tubes in them. But
yeah,
he was here to... What?
How many grandchildren do you have now?
Just the one.
Just the one. We have six.
She's still going to school. So, as a matter
see.
Of fact, I was shocked because they cut his hair the other day.
Oh my.
And he's only 2.5, but he's been having so many problems with his you know, his nose running and everything, and he was getting all the snot in his hair and what. So my son, the Tzaddik, decided on his own he wasn't going to wait until he's 3,
because mm-hmm.
his hair was already halfway down his back.
But this is the son that is from.
Yeah, yeah. It's Moshe, the older one.
Where do they live?
Moshe, they live right here on Ocean Parkway and Avenue N. It's not less than a mile from us.
I see. And the other one?
The other one lives in Denver.
Mm-hmm. Also from?
No. The other one's living with some shiksa girlfriend. I don't know.
How old are the kid boys?
Moshe's 31.
And the other one?
Josh is 27.
Mm-hmm. Shira's 41, Tali 39, and Rivka is 35.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Unbelievable. Time is running.
That's what it is. Time is marching on.
Hmm? Yeah. Rivka had two girls, and then she had twins, a boy and a girl.
Huh.
And Tal has two. Yeah. Anyway, you're still in school? I mean, you still go to school?
Yeah, of course. I teach there 2 days a week.
Uh-huh.
Matter of fact, I'm teaching the Rabbonim this semester. I'm teaching them Psukei Dezimra and Birchas HaShachar for Shabbos and Moedim, and also
mm-hmm.
for Rosh Hashanah, and some of Shachris for Rosh Hashanah, and maybe some Sholosh Regalim if I have a chance.
Mm.
So it's called Nusach for non-musicians.
Yeah. Now, Joe Levine used to teach a course like this.
Mm-hmm.
Don't him.
And I still teach the Sholosh Regalim to the cantorial students, and I coach
right.
9 students.
Wow. You see, and I'm afraid of retiring because in Toronto there's nothing like this. So I can't complain that I went to Toronto. But I'm not part of the action. If I'd be in New York
mm-hmm.
or the Philadelphia, I would have probably been more involved with the schools mm-hmm. and everything.
Well, that's it.
Fortunately, there's nothing here. Nothing.
But so, you should move to Calgary. Then you'll freeze your nuts off.
Yeah.
Is it job open in Calgary?
Yeah. Toronto is not that much colder than New York, but the action is not here. Philadelphia,
right.
the reconstruction is at Gratz
right.
and this.
Right.
I understand
Gratz,
that Jackie's retiring too, no?
Yeah. I don't think Gratz has a cantorial department anymore.
Not anymore, no.
Because Marsha's teaching at JTS now.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Great.
And so is Tillman. Tillman took over the choir.
Yes, I know. See, so Tillman and Murray Simon and all the people that were forced out somehow got these big jobs and happy with you know.
Not such big jobs. They haven't given me a raise in 12 years. Thank God I don't have to live on what they pay me.
But don't you have your pension still?
No, I used that up already. Between all the hospital bills and everything. So.
Did you start collecting? How old are you now? 65?
I'm 66.
Oh, only 2 years younger than I am. I'm 68, yeah. Well, I'm not collecting yet, and I'm not retiring, but I sing very well. I did a beautiful Shabbos here. I did Hasidic Nigunim on Friday night and talked about Hasidism.
Mm-hmm.
And Saturday morning I did Kedusha. I dissected Kedusha, the meaning
mm-hmm.
of the different Kedushot, in a sermon and song, and my choir sang from Salomon Rossi to Milena Bernstein's Mass, Sanctus.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the whole lecture about the Malachim and Hamar.
Oh, did you sing the German Kedusha?
Of course. I did the German Kedusha in Germany. November to put cobblestones in front of the place where Alter lived and in front of the
mm-hmm.
synagogue and my grandparents, where they lived in Hanover. And somebody works on my grandparents in Vienna to put called Stolpersteine, those stones down in Vienna in front of the houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I wish I'd come down to do some lecturing and coaching. I did some master class in Palm Springs
mm-hmm.
in the beginning of the in January.
Mm-hmm. So talk to Nancy.
I'm a has-been. Benny has.
No, I'm the has-been. You're still working.
But nobody knows about me anymore. Anyway, I find Richie very, very invigorating. He's very smart.
Oh, he is, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
He's also very strange. He's also very strange.
Tell me something. How's Bianca?
She's fine, except that the basement of her house got absolutely flooded because, you know, she lives right on the water. And
Didn't her husband die years ago?
What?
Didn't her husband die years ago?
Yeah, a few years ago.
But we had
all of our Pesach stuff in her basement, so we now have no Pesach stuff.
Never. Shame.
And all of Gaina's teaching materials, and Moshe had Sforim down there. Everything was destroyed. They had to rip out her whole basement.
Maybe one of these days we'll see each other.
Maybe.
Are you coming to the convention by any chance since it's in New York?
Well, Steve wants me to. You know, it's not easy for me getting around so much. But
you're not. Are your legs and feet okay? Or
yeah. But you know,
but you didn't gain weight again.
Yeah, I did. But
really?
Not
after
as much as I had
the
before.
Operation?
What?
Even after the operation?
Yeah, you can. There's a way to do it. So. But now I have some heart blockages and, you know, valve problems and what have you, so.
Same.
So they're waiting for me to either drop dead or it should get so bad that they'll operate and do whatever they're going to do, I don't know.
You're talking about dropping dead for 20 years now.
I know, but so I haven't been lucky because I got a wife that won't let me die.
That's right. And all your music, what are we going to do with your music?
Well, it's all at the seminary now, most of
it.
They
gave it to seminary, yes, you told me. Well, Louis Danto's entire library, which was
I know,
cool
it went
room,
to Florida.
Went to Florida, yes.
I know, because I spoke with Aaron a week or so ago.
Yeah.
So I told
him
when he catalogued it. I told him when he catalogs it, I'd like to see what's in there. There must be some interesting stuff there.
Very interesting. I was down there last year. I'm going next week there. You know, I'm doing the big job of republishing Glantz's music with Jerry and Naftali
yeah.
and Raymond.
Right.
So we didn't ask her for commission because I know you can't afford it, but it's like
no.
It's very lovely. It's like 40 compositions that Raymond really simplified and made them very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
From all these crazy books that were printed of Glantz, nobody could
right.
sing any of that.
Right.
So we're now publishing 40 compositions. Let me see if I can find that lecture, and I'll send it you by email.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Give my love
okay.
to Dana. We'll see you, please, God.
God willing. Love to hope.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.